He insisted on being the one to make this climb. It couldn't be a question of time, so maybe it was what Kaz always intended. Maybe he'd meant to keep some bit of information from Matthias, or he was just determined to keep them all guessing. They paused at every landing, listening for patrols. The prison was full of sounds, and it was hard not to jump at every one of them. Voices floating down the stairwell. The metallic clang of doors opening and closing. Nina thought of the violent chaos of Hellgate. Bribes changing hands, blood staining the sand. A world away from this sterile place. The Fjerdans could certainly be counted on to keep things orderly. On their way up the fourth flight, voices and boot steps suddenly burst into the stairwell. Hurriedly, Nina and Kaz backtracked to the third floor landing and slipped through the door leading to the cells. The prisoner in the cell nearest to them started to shout. Nina quickly raised a hand and squeezed his airway shut. He stared at her, eyes bulging, clawing at his neck. She dropped his pulse, sending him into unconsciousness as she released the pressure on his larynx, allowing him to breathe. They needed him quiet, not dead. The noises grew as the guards clambered down the stairs, loud Fjerdan reverberating off the walls. Nina held her breath, watching the door, hands ready. Kaz had no weapon, but he dropped into a fighting stance, waiting to see if the door would crash open. Instead, the guards continued on past the landing, down to the next floor. When the sounds had faded, Kaz signaled to her, and they slipped back out the door, closing it as silently as possible behind them, and continued their ascent. Seven bells struck as they reached the top floor. 1 hour had passed since they'd knocked out the prisoners in the holding area. They had 45 minutes to search the high-security cells, meet back at the landing, and get to the basement. Kaz gestured for her to take the corridor on the left while he took the right. The door creaked loudly as Nina stepped inside. The lanterns were spaced far apart here, and the shadows between them looked deep enough to fall into. She told herself to be grateful for the cover, but she couldn't deny it was eerie. The cells were different, too, with doors of solid steel instead of iron bars. A viewing grate was lodged into each of them at eye level. Well, eye level for a Fjerdan. Nina was tall, but she still had to stand on tiptoe to peek into them. Most of the prisoners were asleep or resting, curled into corners or flat on their backs with an arm thrown over their eyes to block out the dim lamplight that filtered through the grate. Others sat propped against the walls, staring listlessly at nothing. Occasionally she found someone pacing back and forth and had to step away quickly. None of them were Shu.
Ayor?
One called after her in Fjerdan. She ignored him and moved on, heart thudding. What if Bo-Yul Bajor really was in these cells? She knew it was unlikely, and yet she could kill him in his cell, put him in a deep, painless sleep, and simply stop his heart. She'd tell Kaz she hadn't found him. And what if Kaz located Bo-Yul Bajor? She might have to wait until they were out of the ice court to find a solution, but she could at least count on Matthias to help her. What a strange, grim bargain they'd struck. But as she worked her way back and forth along the corridors, the tiny hope that the scientist might be there withered away to nothing. One more row of cells, she thought, then back down to the basement with nothing to show for it. Except when she entered the final corridor, she saw it was shorter than the others. Where there should have been more cells, there was a steel door, bright light shining beneath it. A flutter of unease passed through her as she approached, but she made herself push the door open. She had to squint against the brightness. The light was harsh, as clear as daylight, but with none of its warmth. And she couldn't locate its source. She heard the door whooshing closed behind her. At the last moment, she whirled and grabbed it by the edge. Something told her this door would need a key to unlock it from the inside. She looked for anything she might use to prop it open, and had to settle for tearing off a piece from the bottom of her prison trousers and stuffing it in the lock. This place felt wrong. The walls, floor, and ceiling were a white so clean it hurt to look at. Half of one wall was made up of panels of smooth, perfect glass. Fabricator-made. Just like the glass enclosure surrounding that vile display of weaponry. No Fjordan craftsman could make surfaces so pristine. Grisha power had been used to create this glass. She felt sure of it. There were rogue Grisha who served no country, and who might consider hiring themselves out to the Fjordan government. But would they survive such a commission? Slave labor seemed more likely. Nina took one step, then another. She glanced back over her shoulder. If a guard entered the corridor behind her, she'd have nowhere to hide. So move, Nina. She peered inside the first window. The cell was as white as the hallway, and illuminated by that same sustained bright light. The room was empty and devoid of any kind of furniture. No bench, no basin, no bucket. The only break in all that whiteness was a drain at the very center of the floor, surrounded by reddish stains. She continued to the next cell. It was identical and equally empty, as was the next and the next. But here something caught her eye. A coin lying next to the drain. No, not a coin. A button. A tiny silver button emblazoned with a wing, the symbol of a Grisha squalor. She felt a chill creep over her arms. Had these cells been crafted by Grisha slaves for Grisha prisoners? Had the glass, the walls, the floor been made to withstand fabricator manipulation? The rooms were devoid of metal. There was no plumbing. No pipes to carry water that a tide maker might abuse. And Nina suspected that the glass she was peering through was mirrored on the other side, so that a heart render in the cell wouldn't be able to locate a target. These cells were designed to hold Grisha. Designed to hold her. She wheeled on her heel. Bo Yulbayor wasn't here, and she wanted out of this place right now. She snatched the fabric from the lock and blew through the door, not stopping to make sure it closed behind her. The corridor of iron cells was even darker after the brightness that had come before, and she stumbled as she raced back the way she'd come. Nina knew she was being incautious, but she couldn't get the image of those white rooms out of her head. The drain. The stains around it. Had Grisha been tortured there? Made to confess their crimes against the people? She'd studied the Fjordans. Their leaders. Their language. She'd even dreamed of entering the Ice Court as a spy, just like this. Of striking at the heart of this nation that hated her so much. But now that she was here, she just wanted to be gone. She'd grown used to Ketterdam, to the adventures that came with her involvement with the dregs, to her easy life at the White Rose. But even there, had she ever felt safe? In a city where she couldn't walk down the streets without fear?
I want to go home.
The longing for it hit her hard. A physical ache. I want to go back to Ravka. The elder clock began to chime a soft three-quarter hour. She was late. Still, she forced her steps to slow before she opened the door into the stairway. There was no one there. Not even Kaz. She ducked her head into the opposite passage to see if he was coming. Nothing. Iron doors. Deep shadow. No sign of Kaz. Nina waited. Unsure of what to do. They'd been meant to meet on the landing with 15 minutes to spare before the hour. What if he was in some kind of trouble? She hesitated, and plunged down the corridor Kaz had been responsible for searching. She raced past the cells, the hallways snaking back and forth. But Kaz was nowhere to be found. Enough, thought Nina, when she reached the end of the second corridor. Either Kaz had abandoned her and was already downstairs with the others, or he'd been caught and dragged off somewhere. Either way, she had to get to the incinerator. Once she found the others, they could figure out what to do. She sped back through the halls and threw open the door to the landing. Two guards stood chatting at the head of the stairs. For a moment, they stared at her, open-mouthed.
Sten!
One shouted in Fjordan, ordering her to halt as they fumbled for their guns. Nina threw out both hands, fingers forming fists, and watched the guards topple backward. One fell flat on the landing, but the other tumbled down the stairs, his rifle firing, sending bullets pinging against the stone walls, the sound echoing down the stairwell. Kaz was going to kill her. She was going to kill Kaz. Nina hurtled past the guards' bodies, down one flight, two flights. On the third floor landing, a door flew open as a guard burst into the stairwell. Nina twisted her hands in the air, and the guard's neck broke with an audible snap. She was plunging down the next flight before his body struck the ground. That was when the elder clock began to chime. Not the steady tolling of the hour, but a shrill clamor, high and percussive. A sound of alarm.
25. Inej. Inej looked up into the dark. High above her floated a small gray patch of evening sky. 6 levels to climb in the dark with her hands slippery from sweat and the fires of hell burning below with the rope weighing her down and no net to catch her. Climb, Inej. Bare hands were best for climbing, but the incinerator walls were far too hot to permit that. So Wylan and Jesper had helped her fish Kaz's gloves from the laundry bins. She hesitated briefly. Kaz would tell her to just put the gloves on, to do whatever it took to get the job done, and yet she felt curiously guilty as she slipped the supple black leather over her hands, as if she had crept into his rooms without his permission, read his letters, lain down in his bed. The gloves were unlined, with the slenderest slashes hidden in the fingertips. For sleight of hand, she realized, so that he can keep contact with coins or cards or finesse the workings of a lock. Touch without touch. There was no time to acclimate herself to the oversized feel of the gloves. Besides, she'd climbed with covered hands plenty of times when the Ketterdam winters had turned her fingers numb. She flexed her toes in her little leather slippers, reveling in the familiar feel of them on her feet, bouncing on her nubbly rubber soles. Fearless and eager. The heat was nothing, mere discomfort. The weight of 70 feet of rope coiled around her body? She was the Wraith. She'd suffered worse. She launched herself up into the chimney with pure confidence. When her fingers made contact with the stone, she hissed in a breath. Even through the leather, she could feel the dense heat of the bricks. Without the gloves, her skin would have started to blister right away, but there was nothing to do except hold on. She climbed, hand, then foot, then hand again, seeking the next small crack, the next divot in the soot-slick walls. Sweat coursed down her back. They doused the rope and her clothes in water, but it didn't seem to be doing much good. Her whole body felt flushed, suffused with blood, as if she were being slowly cooked in her own skin. Her feet pulsed with heat. They felt heavy, clumsy, as if they belonged to someone else. She tried to center herself. She trusted her body. She knew her own strength and exactly what she could do. Another hand up, forcing her limbs to cooperate, seeking a rhythm, but finding only an awkward syncopation that left her muscles trembling with every upward gain. She reached for the next hold, digging in. Climb, Imej. Her foot slipped. Her toes lost contact with the wall and her stomach lurched as she felt the pull of her weight and the rope. She gripped the stone, digging into the cracks, Kaz's gloves bunching around her damp fingers. Again, her toes sought purchase, but only slid over the bricks. Then her other foot began to slip, too. She sucked in a gust of searing air. Something was wrong. She risked a glance down. Far below, she saw the red glow of the coals, but it was what she saw on her feet that shocked her heart into a panicked gallop. They were a gummy mess. The soles of her shoes, her perfect, beloved shoes, were melting. It's all right, she told herself. Just change your grip. Put your weight in your shoulders. The rubber will cool as you go higher. It will help you grip. But her feet felt like they were on fire. Seeing what was happening had somehow made it worse, as if the rubber was fusing with her flesh. Inej blinked the sweat from her eyes and hauled herself up a few more inches. From somewhere above, she heard the chime of the elder clock. The half hour? Or quarter till? She had to move faster. She should be on the roof by now, attaching the rope. She pushed higher, and her foot skidded down the brick. She dropped, her whole body stuttering against the wall as she scrambled for purchase. There was no one to save her, no Kaz to come to her rescue, no net waiting to break her fall, only the fire ready to claim her. Inej canted her head back, seeking that patch of sky. It still seemed impossibly distant. How far was it? 20 feet? 30? It might as well have been miles. She was going to die here, slowly, horribly, on the coals. They were all going to die. Kaz, Nina, Jesper, Matthias, Weiland. And it was her fault. No. No, it wasn't. She hefted herself up another foot. Kaz brought us here. And then another. She forced herself to find the next hold. Kaz and his greed. She didn't feel guilty. She wasn't sorry. She was mad. Mad at Kaz for accepting this insane job, furious with herself for agreeing to it. And why had she? To pay off her debt? Or because, despite all good sense and better intentions, she'd let herself feel something for the bastard of the barrel? When Inej entered Tanta Helene's salon on that long-ago night, Kaz Brekker had been waiting, dressed in darkest gray, leaning on his crow's head cane. The salon was furnished in gold and teal, one wall patterned entirely in peacock feathers. Inej hated every inch of the menagerie. The parlor where she and the other girls were forced to coo and bat their lashes at prospective clients. Her bedroom that had been made up to look like some farcical version of a Suli caravan, festooned in purple silk and redolent with incense. But Tanta Helene's salon was the worst. It was the room for beatings, for Helene's worst rages. Inej had tried to escape when she'd first arrived in Ketterdam. She'd gotten 2 blocks from the menagerie, still in her silks, dazed by the light and chaos of West Dave, running without direction, before Cobbett had clamped a meaty hand on the nape of her neck and hauled her back. Helene took her into the salon and beat her badly enough that she hadn't been able to work for a week. For the month after, Helene had kept her in golden chains, not even letting her go down to the parlor. When she'd finally unlocked the shackles, Helene had said, "You owe me for a month of lost income. Run again, and I'll have you thrown in Hellgate for a breach of contract." That night she'd entered the salon with dread, and when she'd seen Kaz Brekker there, her dread only doubled. Dirty Hands must have informed on her. He'd told Tanta Helene that she'd spoken out of turn, that she'd been trying to make trouble. But Helene had leaned back in her silken chair and said, "Well, little lynx, it seems you're someone else's problem now. Apparently, Per Haskell has a taste for Suli girls. He's purchased your indenture for a very tidy sum." Inej swallowed. "I'm moving to a different house." Helene waved a hand. "Haskell does own a pleasure house, if you can call it that, somewhere in the lower barrel, but you'd be a waste of his money there. Though you'd certainly learn just how kind Tanta Helene has been to you. No, Haskell wants you for his very own." Who was Per Haskell? "Does it matter?" said a voice inside her. "He's a man who buys women, that's all you need to know." Inej's distress must have been obvious, because Tanta Helene laughed lightly. "Don't worry. He's old, disgustingly old, but he seems harmless enough. Of course, one never knows." She lifted a shoulder. "Perhaps he'll share you with his errand boy, Mr. Brekker." Kaz turned his cold eyes on Tanta Helene. "Are we done?" It was the first time Inej had heard him speak, and she was startled by the rough burn of his voice. Helene sniffed, adjusting the neckline of her shimmering blue gown. "We are indeed, you little wretch." She heated a stick of peacock blue wax and affixed her seal to the document before her. Then she rose and examined her reflection in the looking glass that hung above the mantel. Inej watched Helene straighten the diamond choker on her neck, the jewels glinting brightly. through the din of confusion in her head, Inej thought. They look like stolen stars. Goodbye, little lynx, said Tanta Helene. I doubt you'll last more than a month in that part of the barrel. She glanced at Kaz. Don't be surprised if she runs. She's faster than she looks. But maybe Per Haskell will enjoy that, too. See yourselves out. She swept from the room in a billow of silk and honeyed perfume, leaving a stunned Inej in her wake. Slowly, Kaz crossed the room and shut the door. Inej tensed for whatever was to come next, fingers twisting in her silks. Per Haskell runs the dregs, Kaz said. You've heard of us.
They're your gang.
Yes, and Haskell is my boss. Yours too, if you like. She summoned her courage and said,
And if I don't like?
I withdraw the offer and go back home looking like a fool. You stay here with that monster, Helene. Inez's hand flew to her mouth.
She listens, Inez whispered, terrified.
Let her listen. The barrel has all kinds of monsters in it, and some of them are very beautiful indeed. I pay Helene for information. In fact, I pay her too much for information. But I know exactly what she is. I asked Per Haskell to pay off your indenture. Do you know why?
You like Sully girls?
I don't know enough Sully girls to say.
He moved to the desk and picked up the document, tucking it in his coat.
The other night when you spoke to me...
I meant no offense, I...
You wanted to offer me information. Perhaps in return for help. A letter to your parents, some extra pay.
Inej cringed. That was exactly what she'd wanted. She'd overheard gossip about a silk trade, and had thought to make some kind of exchange. It was foolish, brash.
Is Inej Gaffa your real name?
A strange sound escaped Inej's throat, part sob, part laugh. A weak, embarrassing sound, but it had been months since she'd heard her own name, her family name. Yes, she managed.
Is that what you prefer to be called?
Of course, she said, then added. Is Kaz Brekker your real name?
Real enough. Last night when you approached me, I didn't know you were anywhere near me until you spoke.
Inej frowned. She wanted to be silent, so she had been. What did that matter?
Bells on your ankles,
Kaz said, gesturing to her costume.
But I didn't hear you. Purple silks and spots painted on your shoulders. But I didn't see you. And I see everything.
She shrugged, and he cocked his head to one side.
Were you trained as a dancer?
An acrobat. She paused. My family were all acrobats.
High wire?
And swings. Juggling. Tumbling.
Did you work with a net?
Only when I was very little.
Good. There aren't any nets in Ketterdam. Have you ever been in a fight?
She shook her head.
Killed someone?
Her eyes widened. No.
Ever think about it?
She paused and then crossed her arms. Every night.
That's a start.
I don't want to kill people, not really.
That's a solid policy until people want to kill you. And in our line of work, that happens a lot.
Our line of work?
I want you to join the dregs.
Doing what?
Gathering information. I need a spider to climb the walls of Ketterdam's houses and businesses, to listen at windows and in the eaves. I need someone who can be invisible, who can become a ghost. Do you think you could do that?
I'm already a ghost, she thought. I died in the hold of a slaver ship. I think so.
This city is full of rich men and women. You're going to learn their habits, their comings and goings. The dirty things they do at night. The crimes they try to cover by day. Their shoe sizes. Their safe combinations. The toy they loved best as a child. and I'm going to use that information to take away their money.
What happens when you take their money and you become a rich man?
Kaz's mouth had quirked slightly at that. Then you can steal my secrets, too.
This is why you bought me?
The humor vanished from his face. Parhaskal didn't buy you. He paid off your indenture. That means you owe him money, a lot of it, but it's a real contract. Here, he said, removing Helene's document from his coat. I want you to see something.
I don't read Kirch.
It doesn't matter. See the numbers? This is the price Helene claims you borrowed from her for transport from Ravka. This is the money you've earned in her employ. And this is what you still owe her.
But that's not possible. It's more now than when I got here.
That's right. She charged you for room, board, grooming.
She bought me, Inej said, her anger rising despite herself. I couldn't even read what I was signing.
Slavery is illegal in Kirch. Indentures are not. I know this contract is a sham, and any thinking judge would too. Unfortunately, Helene has many thinking judges in her pocket. Parhaskal is offering you a loan. No more, no less. Your contract will be in Ravkin. You'll pay interest, but it won't break you. And as long as you pay him a certain percentage every month, you'll be free to come and go as you please.
Inej shook her head. None of this seemed possible.
Inej, let me be very clear with you. If you skip out on your contract, Haskell will send people after you. People who make Tanta Helene look like a doting grandmother. And I won't stop him. I'm putting my neck on the line for this little arrangement. It's not a position I enjoy.
If this is true, Inej said slowly, then I'm free to say no.
Of course. But you're obviously dangerous, he said. I'd prefer you never become dangerous to me.
Dangerous. She wanted to clutch the word to her. She was fairly sure this boy was demented or just hopelessly deluded, but she liked that word. And unless she was mistaken, he was offering to let her walk out of this house tonight. It isn't a trick, is it? Her voice was smaller than she wanted it to be. The shadow of something dark moved across Kaz's face.
If it were a trick, I'd promise you safety. I'd offer you happiness. I don't know if that exists in the barrel, but you'll find none of it with me.
For some reason, those words had comforted her. Better terrible truths than kind lies. All right, she said. How do we begin?
Let's start by getting out of here and finding you some proper clothes.
Oh.
And Inej,
he said as he led her out of the salon.
Don't ever sneak up on me again.
The truth was she'd tried to sneak up on Kaz plenty of times since then. She'd never managed it. It was as if once Kaz had seen her, he'd understood how to keep seeing her. She'd trusted Kaz Brekker that night. She'd become the dangerous girl he'd sensed lurking inside her, but she'd made the mistake of continuing to trust him, of believing in the legend he'd built around himself. That myth had brought her here to this sweltering darkness, balanced between life and death like the last leaf clinging to an autumn branch. In the end, Kaz Brekker was just a boy, and she'd let him lead her to this fate. She couldn't even blame him. She'd let herself be led because she hadn't known where she'd wanted to go.
The heart is an arrow.
4 million Kruger, freedom, a chance to return home. She'd said she wanted these things, but in her heart she couldn't bear the thought of returning to her parents. Could she tell her mother and father the truth? Would they understand all she'd done to survive, not just at the menagerie, but every day since? Could she lay her head in her mother's lap and be forgiven? What would they see when they looked at her?
Climb, Inej.
But where was there to go? What life was waiting for her after all she'd suffered? Her back ached. Her hands were bleeding. The muscles in her legs shook with invisible tremors, and her skin felt like it was ready to peel away from her body. Every breath of black air seared her lungs. She couldn't breathe deeply. She couldn't even focus on that gray patch of sky. The sweat kept beating down her forehead and stinging her eyes. If she gave up, she'd be giving up for all of them. For Jesper and Wylan. For Nina and her Fjärden. For Kaz. She couldn't do that.
It isn't up to you any longer, little lynx.
Tanta Helene's voice crooned in her head.
How long have you been holding on to nothing?
The heat of the incinerator wrapped around Inej like a living thing, a desert dragon in his den, hiding from the ice, waiting for her. She knew her body's limits, and knew she had no more to give. She'd made a bad wager. It was as simple as that. The autumn leaf might cling to its branch, but it was already dead. The only question was when it would fall.
Let go, Inej.
Her father had taught her to climb, to trust the rope, the swing, and finally to trust her own skill, to believe that if she leapt, she would reach the other side. Would he be waiting for her there? She thought of her knives hidden away aboard the Ferelind. Maybe they could go to some other girl who dreamed of being dangerous. She whispered their names. Peter. Maria. Anastasia. Vladimir. Lisabetta. Sancta Alina, martyred before she could turn 18.
Let go, Inej.
Should she jump now or simply wait for her body to give out? Inej felt wetness on her cheeks. Was she crying? Now? After everything she'd done and had done to her? Then she heard it. A soft patter. A gentle drum that had no real rhythm. She felt it on her cheeks and face. She heard the hiss as it struck the coals below.
Rain.
Cool and forgiving. Inej tilted her head back. Somewhere she heard bells ringing the three-quarter hour, but she didn't care. She only heard the music of the rain as it washed away the sweat and soot, the coal smoke of Ketterdam, the face paint of the menagerie as it bathed the jute strands of the rope and hardened the rubber on her suffering feet. It felt like a blessing, though she knew Kaz would just call it weather. She had to move now, quickly, before the stones grew slick and the rain became an enemy. She forced her muscles to flex, her fingers to seek, and pulled herself up one foot, then another, again and again, murmuring prayers of gratitude to her saints. Here was the rhythm that had eluded her before, buried in the whispered cadence of their names. But even as she gave thanks, she knew that the rain was not enough. She wanted a storm, thunder, wind, a deluge. She wanted it to crash through Ketterdam's pleasure houses, lifting roofs and tearing doors off their hinges. She wanted it to raise the seas, take hold of every slaving ship, shatter their masts and smash their hulls against unforgiving shores. I want to call that storm, she thought, and 4 million kruger might be enough to do it. Enough for her own ship. Something small and fierce. And laden with firepower. Something like her. She would hunt the slavers and their buyers. They would learn to fear her, and they would know her by her name.
The heart is an arrow. It demands aim to land true.
She clung to the wall, but it was purpose she grasped at long last, and that carried her upward. She was not a lynx, or a spider, or even the wraith. She was Inej Gaffa. And her future was waiting above.
26. Kaz. Kaz sped through the upper cells, sparing brief seconds for a glance through each grate. Bo Yul Bayur would not be here, and he didn't have much time. Part of him felt unhinged. He had no cane. His feet were bare. He was in strange clothes, his hands pale and ungloved. He didn't feel like himself at all. No, that wasn't quite true. He felt like the Kaz he'd been in the weeks before Jordi had died. Like a wild animal fighting to survive. Kaz spotted a shoe prisoner lurking at the back of one of the cells. Sashuya, Kaz whispered. But if the man recognized the code word, he didn't acknowledge it. Yul Bayur. Nothing. The man started shouting at him in Shu, and Kaz hurried away, passed the rest of the cells, then slipped out to the landing and charged down to the next level as fast as he could manage. He knew he was being reckless, selfish, but wasn't that why they called him Dirty Hands? No job too risky, no deed too low. Dirty Hands would see the rough work done. He wasn't sure what was driving him. It was possible Pekka Rollins wasn't here. It was possible he was dead. But Kaz didn't believe it. I'd know. Somehow I'd know. Your death belongs to me, he whispered. The swim back from the Reaper's barge had been Kaz's rebirth. The child he'd been had died of firepox. The fever had burned away every gentle thing inside him. Survival wasn't nearly as hard as he'd thought, once he left decency behind. The first rule was to find someone smaller and weaker and take what he had. Though, small and weak as Kaz was, that was no easy task. He shuffled up from the harbor, keeping to the alleys, heading toward the neighborhood where the Hertzunes had lived. When he spotted a sweatshop, he waited outside. Then waylaid a chubby little schoolboy lagging behind his friends. Kaz knocked him down, emptied his pockets, and took his bag of licorice. "Give me your trousers," he said. "They're too big for you," the boy had cried. Kaz bit him. The boy gave up his trousers. Kaz rolled them in a ball and threw them in the canal, then ran as fast as his weak legs would take him. He didn't want the trousers. He just wanted the boy to wait before he went wailing for help. He knew the schoolboy would huddle in that alley for a long while, weighing the shame of appearing half-dressed in the street with the need to get home and tell what had happened. Kaz stopped running when he reached the darkest alley he could find in the barrel. He crammed all the licorice into his mouth at once, swallowing it in painful gulps, and promptly vomited it up. He took the money and bought a hot roll of white bread. He was barefoot and filthy. The baker gave him a second roll just to stay away. When he felt a bit stronger, a bit less shaky, he walked to East Stave. He found the dingiest gambling den, one with no sign and just a single lonely barker out front. "I want a job," he said at the door.
"Don't have any nub."
"I'm good with numbers," the man laughed.
"Can you clean a piss pot?"
"Yes."
"Well, too bad. We already have a boy who cleans the piss pots."
Kaz waited all night until he saw a boy about his age leave the premises. He followed him for 2 blocks, then hit him in the head with a rock. He sat down on the boy's legs and pulled off his shoes, then slashed the soles of his feet with a piece of broken bottle. The boy would recover, but he wouldn't be working anytime soon. Touching the bare flesh of his ankles had filled Kaz with revulsion. He kept seeing the white bodies of the Reaper's barge, feeling the ripe bloat of Geordi's skin beneath his hands. The next evening, he returned to the den. "I want a job," he said. And he had one. From there, he'd worked and scraped and saved. He'd trailed the professional thieves of the barrel and learned how to pick pockets and how to cut the laces on a lady's purse. He did his first stint in jail, and then a second. He quickly earned a reputation for being willing to take any job a man needed done, and the name Dirty Hands soon followed. He was an unskilled fighter, but a tenacious one.
"You have no finesse," a gambler at the Silver Garter once said to him.
"No technique." "Sure I do," Kaz had responded. "I practice the art of pull his shirt over his head and punch till you see blood." He still went by Kaz, as he always had, but he stole the name Brecker off a piece of machinery he'd seen on the docks. Reichveld. His family name was abandoned, cut away like a rotten limb. It was a country name, his last tie to Geordi and his father and the boy he'd been. But he didn't want Jacob Hertzun to see him coming. He found out that the con Hertzun had run on him and Geordi was a common one.
The coffee house and the house on Zelverstraat had been nothing more than stage sets, used to fleece fools from the country. Philip, with his mechanical dogs, had been the roper, used to draw Geordi in, while Margit, Saskia, and the clerks at the trade office had all been shills in on the scam. Even one of the bank officers had to have been in on it, passing information to Hertzun about their customers and tipping him off to newcomers from the country opening accounts. Hertzun had probably been running the con on multiple markets at once. Geordi's little fortune wasn't enough to justify such a setup. But the cruelest discovery was Kaz's gift for cards. It might have made him and Geordi rich. Once he learned a game, it took him mere hours to master it, and then he simply couldn't be beaten. He could remember every hand that had been played, each bet that was made. He could keep track of the deal for up to 5 decks, and if there was something he couldn't recall, he made up for it by cheating. He never lost his love for sleight of hand, and he graduated from palming coins to cards, cups, wallets, and watches. A good magician wasn't much different from a proper thief. Before long, he was banned from play in every gambling hall on East Stave. In each place he went, in each bar and flophouse and brothel and squat, he asked after Jacob Hertzun. But if anyone knew the name, they refused to admit it. Then, one day, Kaz was crossing a bridge over East Stave when he saw a man with florid cheeks and tufty sideburns entering a gin shop. He wasn't wearing staid mercher black any longer, but garish striped trousers and a maroon paisley vest. His velvet coat was bottle green. Kaz pushed through the crowd, mind buzzing, heart racing, unsure of what he meant to do. But at the door to the shop, a giant bruiser in a bowler hat stopped him with one meaty hand. "Shop's closed. I can see it's open." Kaz's voice sounded wrong to him, reedy, unfamiliar. "You'll have to wait." "I need to see Jacob Hertzun." "Who?" Kaz felt like he was about to climb out of his skin. He pointed through the window. "Jacob fucking Hertzun, I want to talk to him." The bruiser had looked at Kaz as if he were deranged. "Get your head straight, lad," he said. "That ain't no Hertzun. That's Pekka Rollins. Want to get anywhere in the barrel? You best learn his name." Kaz knew Pekka Rollins' name. Everyone did. He'd just never seen the man. At that moment, Rollins turned toward the window. Kaz waited for acknowledgement, a smirk, a sneer, some spark of recognition. But Rollins' eyes passed right over him. One more mark, one more cull. Why would he remember? Kaz had been courted by any number of gangs who liked his way with his fists and the cards. He'd always said no. He'd come to the barrel to find Hertzun and punish him, not to join some makeshift family. But learning that his real target was Pekka Rollins changed everything. That night, he lay awake on the floor of the squat he'd holed up in and thought of what he wanted, of what would finally make things right for Geordi. Pekka Rollins had taken everything from Kaz. If Kaz intended to do the same to Rollins, he would need to become his equal, and then his better. And he couldn't do it alone. He needed a gang, and not just any gang, but one that needed him. The next day, he'd walked into the slat and asked Per Haskell if he could use another soldier. He'd known even then, though. He'd start as a grunt, but the dregs would become his army. Had all of those steps brought him here tonight? To these dark corridors? It was hardly the vengeance he dreamed of. The rows of cells stretched on and on, infinite, impossible. There was no way he would find Rollins in time. But it was only impossible until it wasn't. Until he sighted that big frame, that florid face through the grate in an iron door. It was only impossible until he was standing in front of Pekka Rollins' cell.
He was on his side, sleeping. Someone had given him a bad beating. Kaz watched the rise and fall of his chest. How many times had Kaz seen Pekka since that first glimpse in the gin shop? Never once had there been a flicker of recognition. Kaz wasn't a boy any longer. There was no reason Pekka should be able to see the child he'd swindled in his features. But it made him furious every time their paths had crossed. It wasn't right. Pekka's face, Hertzun's face, was indelible in Kaz's mind, carved there by a jagged blade. Kaz hung back now, feeling the delicate weight of his lockpicks like an insect cradled in his palm. Wasn't this what he wanted? To see Pekka brought low, humiliated, miserable, and hopeless, the best of his crew dead on pikes. Maybe this could be enough. Maybe all he needed now was for Pekka to know exactly who he was, exactly what he'd done. He could stage a little trial of his own, pass sentence, and mete it out, too. The other clock began to chime, the 3/4 hour. He should go. There wasn't much time left to go to the basement. Nina would be waiting for him. They all would. But he needed this. He fought for this. It wasn't the way he'd imagined, but maybe it made no difference. If Pekka Rollins was put to death by some nameless Fjordan executioner, then none of this would matter. Kaz would have 4 million Kruga, but Jordy would never have his revenge. The lock on the door gave up easily to Kaz's picks. Pekka's eyes opened, and he smiled. He hadn't been sleeping at all. "Hello, Brecker," Rollins said. "Come to gloat?" "Not exactly," Kaz replied. He let the door slam shut behind him.
Part 5. The Ice Does Not Forgive.
27. Jesper. 8 bells. Where the hell is Kaz? Jesper bounced from foot to foot in front of the incinerator. The dim clang of alarm bells filling his ears, rattling his thoughts. Yellow protocol, red protocol. He couldn't remember which was which. Their whole plan had been built around never hearing the sound of an alarm. Inej had secured a rope to the roof and dropped down a line for them to climb. Jesper had sent the rest of the rope up with Wylan and Matthias, along with a pair of shears he'd located in the laundry, and a crude grappling hook he'd fashioned from the metal slats of a washboard. Then he'd cleaned the spatter of rain and moisture from the floor of the refuse room and made sure there were no scraps of rope or other signs of their presence. There was nothing left to do but wait and panic when the alarm started to ring. He heard people shouting to each other, a hail of stomping boots through the ceiling above. Any minute, some intuitive guards might venture down to the basement. If they found Jesper by the incinerator, the route to the roof would be obvious. He'd be damning not only himself, but the others as well. "Come on, Kaz, I'm waiting on you." They all were. Nina had come charging into the room only minutes before, gasping for breath. "Go," she cried. "What are you waiting for?" "You," Jesper shot back. But when he asked her where Kaz was, Nina's face had crumpled. "I hoped he was with you." She'd vanished up the rope, grunting with effort, leaving Jesper standing below, frozen with indecision. Had the guards captured Kaz? Was he somewhere in the prison fighting for his life? He's Kaz Brekker. Even if they locked him up, Kaz could escape any cell, any pair of shackles. Jesper could leave the rope for him. Pray the rain and the cooling incinerator was enough to keep the bottom of it from burning away. But if he just kept standing there like a podge, he'd give away their escape route, and they'd all be doomed. There was nothing to do but climb. Jesper grabbed the rope, just as Kaz hurtled through the door. His shirt was covered in blood, his dark hair a wild mess. "Hurry," he said without preamble. A thousand questions crowded into Jesper's head, but he didn't stop to ask them. He swung out over the coals and started to climb. Rain was still falling in a light patter from above, and he felt the rope tremble as Kaz took hold beneath him. When Jesper looked down, he saw Kaz bracing himself to sling the incinerator doors closed behind them. Jesper put hand over hand, pulling himself up from knot to knot, his arms beginning to ache, the rope cutting into his palms, bracing his feet against the wall of the incinerator when he needed to, then recoiling at the heat of the bricks. How had Inej made this climb with nothing to hold on to? High above, the Elder Clock's alarm bells still clanged like a drawer full of angry pots and pans. What had gone wrong? Why had Kaz and Nina been separated, and how were they going to get out of this? Jesper shook his head, trying to blink the rain from his eyes, muscles bunching in his back as he rose higher. "Thank the saints," he gasped, when Matthias and Weiland grabbed his shoulders and hauled him up the last few feet. He tumbled over the lip of the chimney and onto the roof, drenched and trembling like a half-drowned kitten. Kaz is on the rope. Matthias and Weiland seize the rope to pull him up. Jesper wasn't sure how much Weiland was actually helping, but he was certainly working hard. They dragged Kaz out of the shaft. He flopped onto his back, gulping air. "Where's Inej?" he panted. "Where's Nina?" "Already on the embassy roof," said Matthias. "Leave this rope and take the rest," Kaz said. "Let's move." Matthias and Weiland tossed the incinerator rope into a grimy heap and grabbed two clean coils. Jesper took one and forced himself to his feet. He followed Kaz to the lip of the roof, where Inej had secured a tether that ran from the top of the prison to the embassy sector roof below. Someone had rigged up a sling for those without the Wraith's particular gift for flouting gravity. "Thank the saints, Jell, and your Aunt Ava," Jesper said gratefully, and slid down the rope, followed by the others. The roof of the embassy was curved, probably to keep the snow off, but it was a bit like walking on the humped back of an enormous whale. It was also decidedly more porous than the prison roof. It was pocked with multiple points of entry, vents, chimneys, small glass domes designed to let in the light. Nina and Inej were tucked up against the base of the biggest dome, a filigreed skylight that overlooked the embassy's entry rotunda. It didn't offer much shelter from the dwindling rain, but should any of the guards on the ring wall turn their attention away from the approach road and onto the rooftops of the court, the crew would be hidden from view. Nina had Inej's feet in her lap. "I can't get all the rubber off her heels," she said, as she saw them approaching. "Help her," said Kaz. "Me?" Jesper said. "You don't mean do it." Jesper crawled over to get a better look at Inej's blistered feet, keenly aware of Kaz tracking his movements. Kaz's reaction to the last time Inej was injured had been more than a little disturbing, though this wasn't nearly as bad as the stab wound, and this time, Kaz didn't have the black tips to blame. Jesper focused on the particles of rubber, trying to draw them away from Inej's flesh the same way he'd extracted ore from the prison bars. Inej knew his secret, but Nina was gaping at him. "You're a fabricator?" "Would you believe me if I said no?"
"Why didn't you tell me?"
"You never asked?" he said lamely. "Jesper, just leave it alone, Nina." She pressed her lips together, but he knew this wasn't the last he'd hear of it. He made himself refocus on Inej's feet.
"Saints," he said.
Inej grimaced. "That bad?" "No, you just have really ugly feet." "Ugly feet that got you on this roof." "But are we stuck here?" asked Nina. The Elder Clock ceased its ringing, and in the silence that followed, she shut her eyes in relief.
"Finally."
"What happened at the prison?" Weiland said, that panicked crackle back in his voice. "What triggered the alarm?" "I ran into two guards," said Nina. Jesper glanced up from his work.
"You didn't put them down?"
"I did, but one of them got off a few shots. Another guard came running, That was when the bells started.
Damn. So that's what set off the alarm. Maybe, said Nina.
Where were you, Kaz? I wouldn't have been in the stairwell if I hadn't wasted time looking for you. Why didn't you meet me on the landing?
Kaz was peering down through the glass of the dome.
I decided to search the cells on the fifth floor, too. They all stared at him.
Jesper felt his temper beginning to fray.
What the hell is this? He said. You take off before Matthias and I get back, then you just decide to expand your search and leave Nina thinking you're in trouble?
There was something I needed to take care of. Not good enough. I had a hunch, Kaz said. I followed it.
Nina's expression was pure disbelief.
A hunch?
I made a mistake, growled Kaz. All right?
No, said Inej calmly. You owe us an explanation.
After a moment, Kaz said, I went looking for Pekka Rollins. A look passed between Kaz and Inej that Jesper didn't understand. There was knowledge in it that he had been locked out of.
For saints' sake, why? Asked Nina.
I wanted to know who in the dregs leaked information to him. Jesper waited.
And?
I couldn't find him.
What about the blood on your shirt? Matthias asked.
Run in with a guard. Jesper didn't believe it. Kaz ran a hand over his eyes.
I screwed up. I made a bad call, and I deserve the blame for it. But that doesn't change our situation.
What is our situation? Nina asked Matthias.
What will they do now?
The alarm was yellow protocol, a sector disturbance. Jesper pushed at his temples.
I don't remember what that means.
My guess is that they think someone's attempting a prison break. That sector is already sealed off from the rest of the ICE court, so they'll authorize a search. Probably try to figure out who's missing from the cells.
They'll find the people we knocked out in the women's and men's holding areas, said Weilin. We need to get out of here. Forget Boyobeyer.
Matthias cut a dismissive hand through the air. It's too late. If the guards think there's a prison break in progress, the checkpoints will be on high alert. They're not going to let anyone just walk through.
We can still try, said Jesper.
We get Inej's feet patched up. She flexed them, then stood, testing her bare soles on the gravel. They feel all right. My calluses are gone, though.
I'll give you an address where you can mail your complaints, Nina said with a wink.
Okay. The Wraith is ambulatory, Jesper said, rubbing a sleeve over his damp face. The rain had faded away to a light mist. We find a cozy room to bash some partygoers on the head and waltz out of this place decked in their finest.
Past the embassy gate and two checkpoints, Matthias said skeptically.
They don't know anyone escaped the prison sector. They saw Nina and Kaz, so they know people are out of their cells. But the guards at the checkpoints are going to be looking for hoodlums in prison clothes, not sweet-smelling diplos in fancy dress. We have to do this before they get wise to the fact that six people are on the loose in the outer circle.
Forget it, said Nina. I came here to find Bo Yul Bayur, and I'm not leaving without him.
What's the point? Said Weilin. Even if you manage to get to the White Island and find Yul Bayur, we'll have no way out.
Jesper's right. We should go now while we still have a chance.
Nina folded her arms. If I have to cross to the White Island alone, I will.
That may not be an option, said Matthias.
Look. They gathered around the base of the glass dome. The rotunda below was a mass of people, drinking, laughing, greeting each other. A kind of raucous party before the celebrations on the White Island. As they watched, a group of new guards pushed into the room, trying to form the crowd into lines.
They're adding another checkpoint, Matthias said. They're going to review everyone's identification again before they allow people to access the glass bridge.
Because of yellow protocol? Asked Jesper. Probably. A precaution. It was like seeing the last bit of their luck drain from a glass.
Then that decides it, said Jesper. We cut our losses and try to get out now. I know a way, Inez said quietly. They all turned to look at her. The yellow light from the dome pooled in her dark eyes. We can get through that checkpoint and on to the White Island. She pointed below to where two groups of people had entered the rotunda from the gatehouse courtyard and were shaking the mist.